A passage from John chapter 12. And we'll start with verse 9. Chapter 12 of John, verse 9. This is taking place right after Yeshua's feet have been washed by Mary as he reclined at the table. And in verse 9, the great multitude therefore of the Jews learned that he was there, that is at Bethany, at Bethany. And they came, not for Yeshua's sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. But the chief priests took counsel they might put Lazarus to death also. So here's a warning to you. If you've been touched by Yeshua, and you've been passed from death to life, then it's also open season on you as well. Because if they hate Yeshua, the giver of life, they're going to hate the ones who have received life from him. So don't be shocked if the world persecutes you. Be honored. Be honored. That's what Yeshua tells us. When you're persecuted for righteousness' sake, rejoice. Because that's how they treated the prophets. You're in good company. This is a compliment. But make sure it's for the sake of righteousness and you're not getting persecuted just because you're acting like a bonehead. You know what I'm saying? Because this is personal experience. There are times I acted like a bonehead, but on my own self-righteousness, I thought I was being persecuted for righteousness' sake. And I wasn't. I was being persecuted because I deserved it. So let's make sure that Yeshua's life shines through us. And one of the evidences of that is that the world's going to treat us the way it did him. But anyways, verse 11. Because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and were believing in Yeshua. On the next day, the great multitude had come to the feast when they heard that Yeshua was coming to Jerusalem, took the branches of the palm trees and went out to meet him and began to cry out, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel. And Yeshua, finding a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming seated on a donkey's colt. These things his disciples did not understand at the first. But when Yeshua was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things to him. And so the multitude who were with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead were bearing him witness. For this cause also the multitude went and met him, because they heard that he had performed this sign. The Pharisees therefore said to one another, You see that you are not doing any good. Look, the world has gone after him. I want to take some time, probably about the next 20 minutes, and provide some background to what's happening here. And with that background, I think we're going to see this passage not as we've ever seen it before. We're going to see it in a way that John's referring to. Did you catch that verse? In verse 16, these things his disciples did not understand at the first. But when Yeshua was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written of him. There are a number of things here that I want us to understand, but we need to go back and get some foundation from the prophets. And if we do that, then this passage is going to take on a whole new light. So we're going to go back, we're going to begin in the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel. And if you haven't done a study of the book of Daniel, then you're really, really missing something powerful and something wonderful. So I'm going to give you about a 5-minute crash course in some of the foundation of Daniel and his prophecies. In Daniel, you know the story of how Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. But he didn't understand the dream. In fact, he couldn't even remember the dream. I know, you can't see the screen, can you? All right, I'll point and tell you what it says, okay? But he couldn't even remember the dream. What we have here on the overhead are three columns. It says kingdom. This says Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And the third column says Daniel's vision. Now what these three columns are this. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Daniel finally came forth and not only told him what he dreamed, but then interpreted the dream. And it turned out that what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed concerned four major worldly kingdoms that were to follow. Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, the kingdom of Babylon, was the first. And then it would be followed by a second kingdom, then a third kingdom, and then a fourth kingdom, and then the Messianic kingdom. And that takes place in Daniel chapter 2. And the best we can figure, Nebuchadnezzar had that dream around 600 B.C. About 600 B.C., 600 years or so before what we just read in John chapter 12. Now in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel had not a dream, but a vision. And a vision is a little higher quality than a dream. A vision is something you have with your eyes open. And Daniel didn't need an interpreter to come along. The angel that brought him the vision also told him exactly what the vision meant. And in Daniel's vision, it covered the same information that was covered in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, but with a difference. Let's go through. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he dreamed he saw this incredible statue. This huge statue just went right on up into the sky. And the statue had a head of gold. And Daniel interpreted this and says, this head of gold, the statue, represents you, Nebuchadnezzar, and your kingdom of Babylon. So we have Babylon's the kingdom. The head of gold in Nebuchadnezzar's dream represents that kingdom. But in Daniel's vision, which took place about 50 years later, about 550 B.C., he saw Babylon represented by a lion. A lion that's made to stand up on its hind legs, and a man's heart was given to it. Because remember Nebuchadnezzar, you'll read in Daniel, he lost his mind and went insane for 7 years, and later his mind is returned to him. And when he did, he wrote a pamphlet, which is included in the book of Daniel, as a pamphlet. I guess you could say it's the first gospel tract in the world. And Nebuchadnezzar penned this and sent it to the whole world, praising the God of Israel. It's quite something to read. It's in the book of Daniel. So he saw Babylon not as a head of gold, but as a beast, a lion. Now, in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he saw this statue had a chest and arms of silver. Now, silver is not worth as much as gold. And in Daniel's vision, he saw a bear. And this bear and this chest of arms and arms of silver represent the Media-Persian empires, a dual empire. Just like the statue had two arms, Babylon was conquered by Media-Persia, this dual kingdom. It wasn't as glorious. Wasn't as effective, wasn't as high class as Babylon. So it's of a lesser metal. And just as a bear is not as high class as a lion, at least not in my opinion, the bear, this big brute, doesn't move that quick, but just huge, kind of rolls over, just kind of squashes its enemy, and this bear had several ribs in its teeth, which represented the kingdoms that Media-Persia conquered in order to become the kingdom that covered the world. Next in this dream and vision, in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the statue had a waist and stomach of brass. Now, brass is not worth as much as silver, is it? And in Daniel's dream, he saw a leopard with four wings, saying, move quick. And a leopard's very cagey, very, very difficult to hunt and catch. And Daniel's told, and he also told Nebuchadnezzar, that this represented the kingdom of Greece. And we know from history, so just as Media-Persia conquered Babylon, Greece later on conquered Media-Persia. And who was the Greek king who led Greece in this victory and conquered the world? What was his name? Who? Alexander the Great, correct. And the Bible has somewhat to say about Alexander the Great. Now, after Greece came the kingdom of Rome. And Rome, in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, is pictured as legs of iron. And just as legs are the longest part of the body, the Roman Empire lasted longer than all the other three. And just as there are two legs, the Roman Empire split into two parts. There was the Eastern Realm and there was the Western Realm, and that's the way it continued. And in Daniel's vision, Rome is pictured as a monster. This hideous monster is almost indescribable. And just as the legs are made of iron, which is not worth as much as brass, Daniel's vision of this monster had teeth of iron. Okay? And then, the next is what we call the revived Roman Empire. Because the feet of the statue was made, they were made of iron mixed with clay. They're partly strong, partly weak. And just as these feet had 10 toes, Daniel, in his vision, sees this monster grow 10 horns, which are 10 kingdoms. The Roman Empire breaks up into 10 kingdoms. We call this the revived Roman Empire. And then the last world kingdom, the one that will last for eternity, is the Messianic Kingdom. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he saw this stone cut out without hands, and it came rolling down, and it hit the statue in the feet. In other words, it comes not during the time of Babylon, or in the time of Medo-Persia, or time of Greece, or time of Rome, but in the time of the revived Roman Empire. It hits the feet of clay. And when those break, everything crumbles down. It all destroys. And he says he watched as the stone grew into a stone that filled the whole world. And in Daniel's vision, he describes his kingdom and describes the coming of the Son of Man, which we studied here a number of weeks ago. Not a beast, not a lion, a bear, a leopard, a monster, but the Son of Man himself. Okay? And this is a kingdom that it says lasts for all eternity. It's never replaced and superseded by another kingdom. So in chapter 2 of Daniel and in chapter 7 of Daniel, what we see is man's view of human history, which is this incredible statue, and God's view of human history. A bunch of ravenous, carnivorous beasts devouring one another. A little different tale, isn't it? I remember so well in college and in high school, we would be given books to read. The Glory of Greece. You know, the Splendor of Rome. Listen, there might have been a little glory, a little splendor, but it's mostly just slavery and blood and tears and heartache and destruction and fire, and there wasn't a whole lot of splendor and glory to it. Maybe in man's eyes there was. In God's eyes, it was just a bunch of wild animals eating each other. But God's kingdom, isn't it interesting? Stone is not worth near as much as iron or brass or silver or gold. But rock is lasts forever. So it's simple. It's pure. But it's something that endures for eternity. Because it's harder than all the rest of them, isn't it? It's something that endures. And the Son of Man comes with the clouds. Now, I bring this up because this leads us into the next thing. Let's go to Daniel chapter 8. In Daniel chapter 8, God, in this chapter, let me give a little background. Daniel lived to see Babylon fall and Medo-Persia take its place. He actually lived through this transition. He witnessed what had been prophesied. It's a pretty amazing thing. And just as he served Nebuchadnezzar under Babylon, he then served the king of Medo-Persia as a wise man. He kept his position even though the kingdom around him changed. And then God gives him in chapter 8 some information about the third kingdom, the kingdom of Greece. And he gives him a vision that's more detailed. And I want us to look at that vision. So go to Daniel chapter 8. And it says there, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking, that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram, a picture in your mind, a ram. You know what a ram is, okay? A ram, which had 2 horns, one standing in front of the canal. It was standing in front of the canal. Now the 2 horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. Now a little later on, the angel is going to interpret this and tell Daniel that this ram represents Medo-Persia. The 2 horns represent the Medo-Persia Empire, the Persian Empire. And one was stronger than the other, but the stronger one was younger than the smaller one. Okay, the bigger one came up last. Okay, you catch the picture? So all these details have significance. I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward. Got the directions in your mind? Why? Because it came from the east. It didn't have to butt to the east. It came from the east. Media Persia is to the east. It came from the east and butted north, south, and west. All right, now let's watch what happens next. And no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. While I was observing, verse 5, behold, a male goat, not a ram, just a male goat, was coming from the west. Over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. This goat is fast. And the goat had a conspicuous horn, one horn, not two horns, but one horn between its eyes. Like a unicorn, like a unigoat or something. I don't know what's going on. And he came up to the ram, which had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. So this goat is mad about something. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Now, what is this horn? Who is this flying goat with this one horn between his eyes? Well, go on down now to verse 15, where this vision is interpreted. Verse 15. And it came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, that I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai and the canal. And he goes on to explain to him. Let's go on down to verse 19. And he said, behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of indignation for pertains to the appointed time of the end. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. Now, which direction did the goat come from? From the west, because Greece is to the west of Media Persia. Okay? So the ram came from the east, the goat comes from the west. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. And the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. You see, Alexander the Great died at a young age. And he had no children. There was no one to leave the kingdom to. So he had four main generals. And when Alexander the Great died, in fact, he was at India. He was attacking the kingdoms of, in India, cities in India. He got sick and he died. It was on June 10th, in fact. And he died. There was no one to leave his kingdom to. So his four generals rose up and they split the kingdom into four. Just as this horn is broken off and up came four horns in its place. And now remember, this is all written about 225 years before Alexander the Great was even born. Okay? Pretty amazing stuff. Pretty amazing stuff. Now let's go on to Zechariah. Next to the last book in the English Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, it's not near the end. The last book of the Bible in the Hebrew Bible is actually the book of Daniel. I believe, is that correct? Is it Chronicles? I'm sorry. Daniel is not with the. What I'm thinking of is Daniel's not found in the section of the prophets in the Hebrew Tanakh. It's found in the section of the writings for some reason. Yeah, you're right. Chronicles. I'm sorry. As soon as I said that, I knew something was awry. Okay, Zechariah chapter 9. Zechariah chapter 9. Everybody there? Okay, go to the last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, and back up one. You're in Zechariah. Okay? Now, Zechariah was written around 500 B.C. About 500 B.C., about 50 years after Daniel's vision in Daniel chapter 7 and 8. Okay? About 50 years later. So their lives may have overlapped. Probably did. The burden of the word of the Lord against the land of Hadrach. with Damascus as its resting place, for the eyes of men, especially of all the tribes of Israel, are toward the Lord. And Hamath also, which borders on it. Tyre, now you don't have to write these words down, but I'm going to put them down. Tyre and Sidon, which are up in the north part. There's Damascus, and as you come down, there's Tyre and Sidon, right on the coast, the northwestern coast of Israel. Though they are very wise, for Tyre built herself a fortress and piled up silver like dust and gold like the mire of the streets, behold, the Lord will dispossess her and cast her wealth into the sea, and she will be consumed with fire. Ashkelon will see it and be afraid. Gaza, too, will writhe in great pain. Also Ekron, for her expectation has been confounded. Moreover, the king will perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon will not be inhabited. Gaza, there are a number of cities. You've heard of the Gaza Strip, which is over on the eastern side of Israel, right there on the east side of the Jordan River. On the west side of the Jordan River, and also went up into the area of the Golan Heights and all that area. And a mongrel race will dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines, and I will remove their blood from their mouth and their detestable things from between their teeth. Then they also will be a remnant for our God and be like a clan in Judah, and Ekron like a Jebusite. But I will encamp around my house. Where's that? Jerusalem. I will encamp around my house because of an army, because of him who passes by and returns. Him who passes by and returns. And no oppressor will pass over them anymore. For now I have seen with my eyes. What's being described here is the conquest of Alexander the Great as he conquered Greece, went on up through Turkey and all that area, and he started to come down through Israel from the north, Tyre and Sidon, then over to the northeast, the Gaza area of Gaza and Ashdod, and as he then came down to Jerusalem to conquer Jerusalem. But there's a prophecy here. He gets to Jerusalem, he'll pass by and return, but I've surrounded my house. He won't harm my house. Okay, got the picture? All right, question. It's called the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is what you're thinking is the
Gaza Strip.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yes. Gaza here is a different part. I'm not sure what the word Gaza means. So look it up. But we'll hold that. Maybe I might have that confused. I might have been thinking of another place. Okay, make it the southwest. We'll make this a topic of discussion. We'll figure out what that is. I probably should check the geography more carefully myself. I think you're right. But anyways, the main thing is come from north to south and coming to Jerusalem. Jim, question.
Is there conjecture on why Alexander in sympathy with Israel?
We're going to cover that right now. We're going to cover that right now. Now let's look at the history book. I know you're all wondering, what in the world does this have to do with John 12? Hold on, we're getting there. Josephus was a Roman, actually he was a Jew who wasn't a very good Jew. And he went over and joined the Romans to save his own neck. He wasn't a very good guy, but he was an incredible historian. And he wrote and lived during this period of time, during the conquest of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and when Jerusalem did fall. He writes a bit about John the Baptist and Yeshua, and what life is like in Israel at that time, and what was going on in Rome. And he went back and wrote the whole history of Israel. And he writes about the fulfillment of this time. Because when Josephus writes, which is during the first century, this stuff had already kind of been fulfilled, and now he's writing about it from the viewpoint of a historian who's looking back at the facts, historical facts. And I want you to listen to some of what he says. He writes about Alexander the Great. And here's what he says. Are you ready for this? I'm going to skip down, just read some of the bits that really pertain to our discussion. It talks about how he's conquered Greece, Turkey, and all these areas, and now he's come to the area of Israel. So it says, so Alexander came to Syria and took Damascus. I should have written Damascus here, because that's referred in Zechariah 9. That was the first city, Damascus. And when he obtained Sidon, he besieged Tyre. Got that? There's Damascus and Tyre and Sidon. It took 7 months for him to conquer this area. When he sent a letter to the Jewish high priest in Jerusalem to send him some help, some auxiliaries, and to supply his army with provisions, and that what presents he formerly sent to Darius, the king of Persia, he would now send to him, Alexander, the king of Greece, and choose the friendship of the Greek, the Macedonian, Alexander, and that he should never repent of so doing. In other words, he wrote to the high priest, says, listen, you sent some men to help me fight Tyre, you send provisions for my army, you won't be sorry. And the way you helped Darius the Persian, if you'll now help me, if you'll now help me, you won't be sorry. So what does the high priest do? But the high priest answered the messengers that he had given his oath to Darius not to bear arms against him. And he said that he would not transgress this while Darius was in the land of the living. See, Darius had not yet been conquered yet. He's to the east of Israel. Upon hearing this answer, Alexander was very angry. And though he determined not to leave Tyre, which was just ready to be taken, yet as soon as he had taken it, he threatened that he would make an expedition against the Jewish high priest and through him teach all men to whom they must keep their oaths. So when he had, with a good deal of pains during the siege, taken Tyre and settled its affairs, he came to the city of Gaza and besieged both the city and him that was governor of the garrison. So what's next? Jerusalem. Well, if you were the high priest, how would you feel about this? Now everything's happened just the way Zechariah prophesied. Damascus, Tyre and Sidon, Gaza, and now Jerusalem. Yes, Sharon?
Correct me if my thinking is incorrect. But isn't Darius the offspring of Esther and then the king?
I'm not sure if the same Darius or not. That's a good question. That's a good question. I'm not sure if it's the same one or not.
There's a lineage there mm-hmm. where that Medo-Persian empire, that Esther's children came straight through.
Mm-hmm. You might be right. I think the timing...
Nehemiah to rebuilding Jerusalem and everything.
Yeah.
The Medo-Persian Empire, I thought, was very favorable towards...
That's something to check out.
...the prosperity mm-hmm. of Israel at that point.
Yes. They've had a good relationship.
Strong reasons to.
Yeah.
All tied back to Esther.
That's a very good question. I just thought of that.
Was, Josephus didn't do anything that many people have done throughout history when their lands are being ravaged
yeah.
and pillaged. He chose to live.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would say that makes him a bad Jew, that he wasn't willing to be exterminated.
Yeah. You're right.
If we didn't have him alive, we wouldn't have
you're right.
his pet as one of the major things that we use apologetically,
mm-hmm.
For
yeah.
people.
It's a great resource.
So, we have a lot of Jews who have cohorted with the enemy in an attempt to stay alive.
Yeah.
I don't know that
if he had just done that, I would agree. But history indicates, Josephus doesn't tell us about himself, but other historians do, that there were some other-handed things where he actually took up arms against Israel and actually supported the enemy against his own people. That was crossing the line. But anyways, but I'm so glad he did live because his histories, and there's quite a bit he wrote, have been extremely helpful in Bible study. And understanding this period of time. Well, I want to get back to our story here. What does the high priest do? He realizes Alexander the Great is breathing down his neck. And I know you're wondering, how does this all tie in? Just wait. Just hold on. Hold on. I promise this will be worth it. So it says, but when the 7 months of the siege of Tyre were over and the 2 months of the siege of Gaza, Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up to Jerusalem. He's ticked. And he wants to teach this high priest a lesson. And Judah the high priest, when he heard that, was in agony and under terror, not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. He therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he sought to protect that nation, and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. Whereupon God warned him in a dream. God warned the high priest in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, that the rest should appear in white garments, but that he said the high priest should meet the king, in other words, when Alexander the Great comes in, meet the king and the habits proper to their order, without the dread of any ill consequences which the providence of God would prevent. And Zechariah prophesied, listen, he'll come to Jerusalem, but I've encamped around it. I'll protect it. Okay? He'll pass by and he'll return, and we'll see what that means in a moment.
The high priest is giving him allegiance.
The
reason Alexander is angered doesn't...
Because he didn't give his allegiance to Alexander the Great. He kept his allegiance to Darius, who he had sworn an oath. Yeah. It's Judah. It's how it's written here in this English translation. So I pronounce it Judah. It's J-A-D-D-U-A. So whether it's the same word as Judah or not, I pronounce it Judah because it looks probably the same. In Hebrew, it's probably spelled the same way. Okay. Upon which, after this dream, when he arose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely and so waited for the coming of the king, Alexander the Great. Okay, here comes the king. Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance, he's coming to Jerusalem, he sees this multitude of the priests all dressed in white. He saw the multitude in the distance in white garments, while the priests stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, which with his mitre on his head, having a gold plate whereon the name of God was engraved, holding the Son of the Lord. He had his high priestly garments on, the ephod, the breastplate, the whole works. With his mitre on his head, having a golden plate whereupon the name of God was engraved, he approached by himself and adored that name, and first saluted the high priest. And the Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about. Whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind. However, Parmenio alone went up to him and asked him how it came to pass that when all the others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom he replied, this is what Alexander said, I did not adore him, but that God who has honored him with his high priesthood. For I saw this very person, this high priest. I saw this high priest in a dream, in this very clothing, when I was at Dios in Macedonia. I saw this high priest in a dream. And then I realized God's telling me not to hurt him. So, make a long story short. Listen to this now. You know what the high priest did when he met Alexander and they got chit-chatting? Listen to this. The high priest took out the book of Daniel and showed it to him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians. He supposed that himself was the person intended. And as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. But the next day he called them to him and bade them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers. In other words, let us continue to obey the Torah and pay no tribute on the seventh year, the sabbatical year. That's what we ask. Let us continue to obey the Torah. And we'll continue to pay our taxes to you as we used to do to Darius. But please give us a break on the seventh year as Darius did. And Alexander the Great said, fine, no problem. You catch what happened? As Alexander came to Jerusalem to conquer it, he recognized the high priest because of a dream God had given him. And then the high priest says, I'm going to show you something, Alexander. You're spoken about here in the book of Daniel, written in, you know, quite some time ago before you were born, that you would come. You understand what it means by how he came? He passed by and returned because Alexander left, it's more conquering, and came back to Jerusalem, offered sacrifices there. You get the picture? Now, go back to Zechariah again, chapter 9. The first 8 verses describe Alexander the Great. And in verse 9, things change. The whole scene changes. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. That's what we were reading about in John 12. This is the verse that's quoted in John 12. And when we come back here to this verse, we see that Yeshua, the Messiah, coming to Jerusalem mounted on a donkey, is laid side by side with Alexander coming to Jerusalem, mounted on probably one of the best horses in the world at the time. Why does God put Alexander the Great and Yeshua the Messiah side by side? Why does he do this? Because he wants us to compare their lives. He wants us to compare the way one man goes forth to conquer the world and how the Son of God goes forth to conquer the world. Because remember what it says in John 12? The Pharisees saying the whole world is going after him. Let's make a few comparisons between Alexander the Great and Yeshua. I think you're going to be surprised about some things. In fact, as I was reading last night, I started thinking, I remember that Alexander the Great was a young man when he died. Exactly how old was he? Yeshua was 33, so I thought, I wonder how old Alexander the Great was when he died, 33 years old. They both died the same age. They both had the same length of lifespan. Both of them lived in Egypt for a time. Alexander the Great lived in Egypt for a period of time, and after he died, one of the great Gentile cities, in fact, it was one of the seats of the Jewish communities there in Alexandria, was named after Alexander. Alexandria, Egypt, named after Alexander. And at that time, and during Yeshua's day, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Alexandria. Some estimates put it to over 1 million Jews. It's a strong Jewish community in Alexandria. In fact, when Yeshua went to Egypt when he was a little boy, when he was a baby, his parents took him to Egypt because his father, Joseph, was warned in a dream, go to Egypt till I tell you to leave. It's a good estimate that this is probably where they went, to Alexandria. Here's another interesting thing. After Alexander died, he wasn't buried. The Egyptians used a special embalming technique that is lost now. We don't know how they did it. But they embalmed his body. They encased it in glass. And for centuries, it was on view in Alexandria. And there he is. You could go up to it. It's on this pedestal. There's his body encased in glass, looking as fresh as a daisy, all decked out in his armor with his sword that he conquered the world with at his side. And Yeshua, if Alexandria is where he went and where he was raised, he would have seen Alexander the Great's body. He would have seen him. Here's some other things. Alexander the Great was not a meek and humble man. In fact, he demanded that he be deified and worshipped. I did some research in the Anchor Bible Dictionary, which has quite a long article on Alexander. And it says that Alexander wrote to the Greeks requesting them to worship him as a god. Because Alexander believed himself descended from Heracles, one of the Greek gods, and one of the other, Achilles, as two of his ancestors. And he says he may well have considered that the appropriate recognition of his greatness was to be worshipped as a living god, and that the Greeks were the appropriate people to accord him this honor. And so he demanded worship as a god. Did Yeshua ever do that? Never demanded. In fact, the word tells us that that Yeshua saw equality with God not something to be grasped. You know how Adam, when the serpent came to Eve, and then she went on to Adam, and the Eve says, the day you eat of this, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. So they thought, equality with God is something we can grasp. If we eat this fruit, we'll be like God. But Yeshua did not see equality with God something to be grasped and taken to himself. Alexander the Great demanded worship to be deified. Was he a god? No way. But Yeshua did not demand that. It says that Alexander the Great was passionate in his nature and capable of great excesses in his emotions. Did Yeshua ever show excess emotion? We see him weeping. We know he laughed. We see him angry. We see him reflective, but never out of control. Alexander the Great, he could be extravagantly generous to his friends and to those who voluntarily submitted themselves to him, but ruthless and brutal in suppressing opposition. Was Yeshua this way? What does Yeshua stand towards his enemies? Well, he'd rebuke them, but he loved them. He loved them. Yeah, he was suppressing opposition, real or imagined. Says Alexander the Great was a drunkard, was a drinker, a hard drinker, and capable of great violence when drunk. Was Yeshua ever drunk? He was accused of being a drunkard. Says, of course, he drank wine. He's accused of being a drunkard, but he never was. He's accused of being a glutton, but he never was. Another interesting thing. Alexander lost his father when he was only about 20 years old, but his mother was a strong influence throughout his life. It would appear the same was true with Yeshua. Because we don't see Joseph appearing any time during Yeshua's adult life, but his mother's still there. And you notice she was a strong influence upon him. It says, from his early years, perhaps, under the influence of his mother, he had regarded himself as set apart from the rest of humanity. This is Alexander the Great. And I'm sure that Yeshua heard about his own birth from his own mother. I have news for you, Yeshua. Joseph is not really your father. Well, who is the Father in heaven? Adonai is. And told him the story. You're set apart for something wonderful and great. I mean, think about that. Yeshua had to have heard that information from his mother at some time. He had to have. This article goes on, says there are many deficiencies in Alexander as a ruler. His lust for overseas glory and conquest meant that his native Macedonia was deprived of its king for virtually the whole of his reign. Heaven was deprived of its king as well, but it didn't suffer. Yeshua and Alexander had one thing in common. They both wanted to conquer the world. But boy, their methods were entirely different, weren't they? Alexander went forth with a sword. Yeshua went forth with a sword of the Spirit. Alexander went forth killing and taking lives. Yeshua went forth and laid his down. Alexander fought with armies and with weapons. Yeshua fought his war with love and with words. One was proud and arrogant, the other was meek and humble. One came on a horse, one on a donkey. Do you see what's taking place here in Zechariah chapter 9? The two are laid side by side. And see, John, when he wrote chapter 12, he didn't miss this. He recognized this, because I want you to go to John 12 again and look at some things that are astounding here. You see, after Yeshua rides into Jerusalem, and the Pharisees in verse 19 comment, look, the whole world has gone after him. Alexander, he went across the world conquering it. Yeshua, except for his short sojourn in Egypt, he was a little boy, never left Israel. The world comes to him. The world comes to him. If I be lifted up, I'll do what? I'll draw all men unto myself. That's what he says there down in verse 32. Different mode of operation entirely. But now come to verse 20. We didn't read down to verse 20. Read 20 now. Now there were certain Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. Get the picture? Those who had been the followers of Alexander had studied his life. They were Greeks. They were of Alexander's people. Now they're leaving that and going after Yeshua. Now, they didn't live during the time of Alexander. Don't get me wrong. But Alexander was probably a hero. I mean, when these kids went to school, Alexander would have been a hero. This is this great Greek conqueror conquered the world by the time he's 33 years old. But the Greeks are now going after Yeshua. Alexander's not their hero anymore. Yeshua is becoming their hero. And look what they went to. Verse 21. These therefore came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, which is a very Gentile area of Galilee, and began to ask him, saying, Sir, we wish to see Yeshua. Philip came and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip came, and they told Yeshua. Remember, John rarely shares detail. And when he does, it's important. He mentions Philip and Andrew several times here. Why did he mention them by name? I mean, after all, is this important? When he just said he came to the disciples and said, we want to see Yeshua, and the disciples went to Yeshua and said, we've got some Greeks out here, I want to talk to you. That would have been an easier way to do it. Why is he named Philip and Andrew? Philip and Andrew. Guess what Alexander the Great's father's name was? Philip. His name is Philip. And Alexander can also be pronounced Alex Andrew. See? Because the word Andrew means manly. Alexandru or Alexander means defender of man. So you see, here's Philip, the father of Alexander. Here's the name of one of the disciples. Here's Andrew, who shares a name with Alexander. See what John's doing? He's cluing them in. He had already quoted Zechariah 9 up in verse 15. Fear not, daughter of Zion. Behold, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt. And of course, these men would have known. And especially, it says, after his resurrection, after his glorification, when he thought back and studied the scriptures and say, hey, look what else is in Zechariah 9. Alexander the Great. Wow, our conqueror is a whole lot different from him. And remember those Greeks who came to Yeshua that same day that he fulfilled the prophecy in Zechariah 9? Greeks came to Yeshua. He is drawing the whole world after himself. And now, here's what's interesting. What did Yeshua say to these Greeks who came to him? John doesn't tell us. We don't know anything about the conversation or if they even got to see him. Because the important thing is for us to see what Yeshua said when he found out Greeks were coming to speak with him. They wanted to see him. Look what Yeshua says. And see if now, with the background we've been given, if this doesn't have a new dimension to it. Yeshua answered them, saying, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Where is Son of Man first mentioned? Bears much fruit. He who loves his soul loses it. He who hates his soul in this world shall keep it to life eternal. If anyone serves me, let him follow me. And where I am, there shall my servant also be. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. The Greeks are coming to him, and he begins to rejoice. It's time for the Son of Man to be glorified. There have been a number of times where Yeshua says in John, my hour is not yet come. My hour is not yet come. My hour has not yet come. And then here when the Greeks come, it says, the hour has come. The hour has come. Because now the world is getting conquered. The world is starting to draw near to me. And I'm going to be very fruitful. Alexander the Great left no children behind. And Yeshua left no children behind. But Yeshua left behind millions of spiritual offspring. And it's still continue to reproduce spiritual offspring. We're proof of that. And look at us. Mostly Gentile here. Mostly Gentile. How many of us give two hoots about Alexander the Great, who conquered the world by age 33? And then how many of us give glory and praise to our Messiah, who's drawing all into himself in such a gentle way, in such an incredibly different way by laying down his life instead of taking lives? Jennifer.
One thing that kind of strikes me as we went through the passage and thinking about the Greeks, Alexander the Great was a person that did plenty of little things that It's said about Alexander that he was supposed to be this incredibly beautiful man.
Mm-hmm.
Blonde hair, tall, mostly beautiful physique in the community. But they say when he would ride into the city on his horse, that people were awestruck at what they saw before him because he was just so incredibly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the Greek culture, the Greek society, that was one of the things that they worshipped, beauty in human form, beauty in clothing, one knows that their eyes want to buy, and the clothing that they wore, the way they adorned themselves. You know, beauty of the animals around them, you know, horses and things like that, everything is that they're very visual people. They wanted to see all this beauty. So, and we know from scripture that Yeshua was not, not good looking.
Right.
Not somebody that was, I mean, even Mousy would be a way of describing it. Somebody who would stick out in the crowd on his lips, maybe somebody who would be lost in the crowd if it wasn't for the fact that he was who he was.
Yeah.
So when you think of these Greeks who, everything that they knew and worshipped had to do with beauty, that they were able to give that up to go strictly because of who Yeshua was. I mean, to me that speaks so mightily about what his presence must have been like.
Yeah, for the sake of the people who might be listening to this on tape, I just want to recap what you said. That Alexander the Great historically was a very, very, very attractive man. He's like a Tom Selleck and a Mel Gibson rolled into one. Whereas Yeshua had no beauty or comeliness that we should desire. He was very plain, very plain looking. There's nothing physical about him that you say, oh wow, I'm going to go know that guy. And everything about Alexander the Great was physical and worldly and earthy. Everything about Yeshua is spiritual. Yeah, good point. And yes, there's a hand up over here. Sharon, then Daniel.
You know, the Sharon's Jewish Bible says that they were Greek-speaking Jews.
That's not true. I did some research on that.
And I'm just wondering if that's true, the take on it. I can still take a take on that.
Right.
Because this is a horrible problem in Israel at the time. The Hellenization of the Jews.
Yes.
They were on the brink of, many of them walked away from their religion because they were so enamored with Greek thinking and everything that was just expressed about beauty and everything. And when I see this, I mean, this gave me great hope that even Jews who have gotten so far away from the truth, when it finally does, when they're in its midst, you know, it can grab their attention and pull them back, even from the world.
Yeah.
Because that's what Greece was. Greece was the world. It was everything that Judaism wasn't.
Exactly.
Glorify everything that God wanted people to do.
And that's what Hanukkah is about, too.
It's
the content of Greek culture.
It's not the inside. I mean, it's great if your inside is wonderful, too. But if your inside isn't, then you are really going down the wrong path.
Yeah.
But anyway, as you were speaking, it's much more powerful if it's truly Gentile.
Yeah, if you want to understand what Greek culture was and what Hellenism was in modern terms, it's what we would call humanism today. That's where it came from. Secular humanism, right. And I know that there, one of the things Stern does in his Bible and in his commentary is he's so concentrated on the Jewish aspect that sometimes he forces it a little bit. And I did some research on this. Probably one of the best commentaries on John is one done by Dr. Brown, the Anchor Bible Commentary. It's probably 1,500 pages or so. It's really huge, but it's extremely scholarly, extremely in-depth. And he makes it very clear that these were not just Greek-speaking Jews. These were Greeks. These were indeed Gentiles. And I think we see here in our context that is what fits, too. That would only make sense. Because if we read down a little bit further, let's go on down to let's go down to verse 30. Verse 32. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. The multitude therefore answered him, we have heard out of the Torah that the Messiah is to remain forever. And how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is the Son of Man? Yeshua therefore said to them, for a little while longer the light is among you. Walk while you have the light, that darkness may not overtake you. He who walks in the darkness does not know where he goes. While you have the light, believe in the light, in order that you may become sons of the light. And I'm looking for the place that goes on down and... anyways, in this section... Oh, okay. Verse 42, nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing him, lest they should be put out of the synagogues. They loved the approval of men rather than approval of God. What we see here are Jews, the Jewish rulers are turning to him, the Greeks are turning to him, and the corn of wheat, the seed, are usually referring to his physical body, falling in the grave and dying, separating. Okay, the separation for the soul, the spirit, the body and the spirit. Is going to bring forth great fruit, tremendous fruit. And he's going to draw the world to himself. Doesn't say just the Jews, but draw all men to myself. That's what's the incredible thing about this, in the context in which John is placing this. Daniel, you had your hand up a moment ago.
Yeah, I just want to expand on what Dominic was saying, and it's kind of cool because we just started in my English class studying the Greek and Roman mythology, and we just did the introduction, and it just explains how in Greece they banned fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. Everything was like it was so different from Egypt and every other parts of the world where their gods were, you know, horses and birds, heads with men, and it was all real, and
right.
It was just. They worship man.
Right.
It's so different and that mind-boggling how, I mean, just what Jennifer said, how Jesus' presence must have been, how great it must have been for them to draw them close because that was the complete opposite from
right.
the whole culture.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Greek gods were men, weren't they?
Yep.
The Egyptian gods are all animals and beasts and things.
And,
yeah.
I mean, all their stories, Hercules and Zeus, they all took place in modern-day cities back then.
Yes.
And Homer and they all wrote about just the stories, and you think, well, how could that happen? But they took place, the setting was all in Greece and England, and it was all men fighting for them.
Well, Daniel brings up something that, for me, is the very heart of this whole study. I mean, okay, so we walk away from here, we get some interesting historical background about this chapter. Okay, how does that change us? Here's the message that speaks to me, and Daniel's putting his finger on it. I think we, us right here, Beth Dacoon, and believers all over the world, we're too easily impressed with the world. And we're too hard to impress with God. We get excited and we get, pledge allegiance to this brand of a product or to this way of doing things or to this political persuasion or to this political figure or to whatever it is, and we're impressed by things. How much better this car is than that car, or this team than that team, or this party than that party. And yet when it comes to the things of the Spirit, oh boy, I hope Grant doesn't run over in prayer time today, so go along. How about, honey, we just go in the middle of the prayer time instead of the beginning? Because they're just going to sing that Ma Tovu stuff and the Shema, we hear that every week. You know what I'm saying? And not we lose sight of the fact that we're drawing into God's presence because we can't see it, taste it, touch it, feel it. We're not impressed. We need to learn to be impressed by God and the things of God. And I'm not talking about doctrines and religious people and speakers and, oh, I think this guy's the greatest speaker, or oh, this guy's the better speaker. Not that. I'm talking about God himself. Just as the Ten Commandments, the Torah, was inscribed on rough old pieces of rock, you can look at the rock and say, what's the big deal? Or you can look at the light coming through the letters and say, praise be the Lord. You know what I'm saying? And I think too many times we're looking at the physicality of things instead of at the spirituality of things. We must have eyes to see. And this is what Paul's prayer is in Ephesians. And this is a prayer that we need to pray for the body of believers in the world today. If you want to turn there for a moment to Ephesians. There are two prayers of Paul in this book. One is found in chapter 3, verse 14. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with the power through his Spirit in the inner man, so that Messiah may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Messiah, which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. And be impressed with that stuff, that invisible stuff. Be impressed with that. Seek those things that are above, not the things below. Everything you see is temporary and passes away, but everything that's eternal is invisible and unseen. There's another prayer. And back in chapter 1, verse 15. For this reason I too, having heard the faith in the Lord Yeshua, which exists among you and your love for all the saints, do not cease giving thanks for you while making mention of you in my prayers. Here's the prayer. That the God of our Lord Yeshua the Messiah, the Father of glory, may give to you a spirit of wisdom and of revelation in the knowledge of him. See, we want revelation in the knowledge of future events, of what's going to happen in your life. I want a word for you so we can impress each other with. And that, those things are real. They are real words of knowledge. But so many times we want revelation so that we can use it with our brothers and sisters and we get a reputation as being a prophet or a prophetess or a seer or whatever. But that's not what Paul's about here. I want you to have a spirit of revelation, of wisdom and revelation. Those are the order. There's a lot of revelation about wisdom these days. But wisdom and of revelation in the knowledge of him. Knowledge of him, of Yeshua. I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, so that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the surpassing greatness of his power toward us who believe. These are in accordance with the working of the strength of his might, which he brought about in Messiah, when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. That's what Paul's prayer is for us. That's what our desire should be for us. You got it? You got it? Man alive, if we only studied his kingdom and delved into the riches of his Spirit as much as we do into the sports statistics and the latest gubbins on the newest models of the cars and the horsepower and all this stuff and the mileage and with the best kind of house and the best kind of windows and the best kind of clothes and the best place to eat. If we only looked at the eternal kingdom with that kind of interest, we really would be turning this world upside down. And that's what we need to do. That's what we need to do. Our time on this planet and this life is so short. We have all eternity. Are we preparing for it? Are we preparing for it? You know, when you get ready to take a vacation, don't you get travel books and so on? You're going to a new place, a foreign country. You want to read up about it? Know everything you can about it before you get there. Yet so many of us, I think, are going into the kingdom of God totally blind. We've got our passport. We've got our passport, but we don't have anything. We have no idea what to expect when we get there. We're just going to have fun. Well, you know what? There are going to be tears in heaven. Well, God will wipe them away. But I don't want to be tearful in heaven. There's going to be loss in heaven. I don't want to be one of those. Paul makes it very clear. Some people get to heaven and they will lose. They will lose. And they'll go in basically naked. Because everything they've invested their life is in hay, wood, and stubble, it's all burned up. And they themselves will be saved, but their works are all burned up. They actually suffered loss, he says. Well, it would be that way. And so let's pray for one another that our eyes would be open and we could really have a revelation of wisdom and of knowledge of Him. Knowledge of Him. That's what matters. Don't be impressed by Alexander the Great. Be impressed by Yeshua's. Okay? There's only one. Let's learn of Him. Let's be impressed by Him. His eternal kingdom. You got it? Okay. Jim.
It's interesting that when you look at the achievements of Alexander the Great, you see work. Here was a truly great man that could do anything. And in reality, it's just, as it's already been mentioned, secular humanism camouflaged by all the great things that he did.
Yeah.
It's still the worship of a man rather than God himself. And it's not a matter of jumping from great things to almost being a pacifist.
Yes.
It's jumping from a lie to the truth.
Yes, yeah. And you bring up a good point. The influence of Alexander the Great is still greatly felt in the world today. His impact upon world history is still with us today. Our maps, our politics, and our philosophies are influenced by Alexander the Great. We may not realize that, but that's the truth. And we're also influenced by Yeshua. So you have two contrary influences in your life. Which one is the one you're investing in? Because they're both there. They're both there. Yes, Sharon.
What a head brush it must have been for him when he meets with that high priest in the gates. And I wonder how puffed up he was over the fact that, oh, their God didn't recognize me.
Yeah.
It's which God he thought was greater, him or the God of Isaac.
Well, I also, when I was studying this, I was wondering, I wonder what verse they stopped at. Did they go down and say, and when he's right in the peak of power, that he dies, and his kingdom split into four? I wonder if they read that part to him. I don't know. Because, it sounds glowing up to that point, but then it all crumbles. It all crumbles. So how far did they read? I don't know.
It's a smart enough to stop. Yeah.
Probably so.
You know where to stop.
Probably so. Yeah, Vern.
Well, I had similarities that Alexander had with Jesus Christ, and that is, one, Alexander wanted to establish a city throughout the area.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went into India, his troops were getting discouraged because of the rough terrain and stuff like that, so he had to backtrack and go to Babylon. But every place he went, he established an Alexandria city.
Mm.
Just as Jesus has now established temples in each one of us.
Yes.
He's amongst us.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that when Alexander was dying, he was dying in Babylon, and he wept over the area that he couldn't conquer any more kingdoms. Jesus wept over Jerusalem.
Yes. Good point. Good point. Very good. Well, this has been an insightful study to me. I hope you've enjoyed it and learned from it. But let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. Lord, how wonderful, how wise, how multifaceted it is, how deep it is. Lord, there's just an eternity of study open to us here. So, Lord, I pray be faithful to delve into it and to build it into our minds, to be hearers of your word, so that we can go forth and truly be doers of it. So, Lord, continue to make us the people you want us to be. And we thank you that we have a king, not like Alexander, as great as he may have been, but we worship the King of Kings, the Messiah, not just the defender of man, but the Savior of men. And, Lord, I pray you continue to draw all men to you as we lift you up in our hearts, as we lift you up in our conversation, in our lives, in our actions, that you might be glorified. And we thank you that unlike Alexander the Great, you live, and you live forever. Lord, you're a king who's truly worth worshiping. And you never demand that we do that. You never demand that we deify you. Lord, you give us a desire to do that. And we thank you for Yeshua, because through him, Lord, we freely know who you are. And Lord, it's our heart's desire to make you our God. For you're our creator, and you are truly our King. We praise you and thank you for your word, for your Messiah. In Yeshua's name, amen.